Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the, as Mr. Withers has already noted, the April Fool's edition of the Education Finance Committee. Today we are doing two things that are no joke. We are walking through both the education, the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division report, and then the DE that is the Education Finance Division report. Both of them will be, well, why don't we just get started? How about that? Chair Pinto, and as he's coming forward, we wanted to make sure that while much, if not all, of this is already incorporated into the DE amendment that was posted around for House File 2400, that was posted Saturday night around 8 o'clock, I believe, we wanted Chair Pinto to come before the committee and be able to walk through his bill so that members and the community, the public, were fully informed. So with that, the chair moves we adopt the Early Education Finance and Policy Division report. Any discussion to that motion? Yes. Representative Krishan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to walk through it. Are you actually going to call for a vote, or are you going to allow us to discuss it and then have public testimony? I think that would be the more appropriate then before we do a vote. Any, just asking on process and what would be appropriate.
So this is just, Representative Krishan, this is just the adoption of the division report. This is not a vote on the substance of the bill. We're just saying at this point that he gets to talk about it in front of the committee. The Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division report has already been incorporated into the DE, the lead-all amendment for House File 2400. We'll be allowing testimony on that tomorrow, today if there's time, and then again tomorrow. And then we will do amendments on Thursday and vote it out. So does that...
Mr. Chair.
We wanted people to have time to read things before they either testified or voted. Representative Krishan.
And, Mr. Chair, I understand that. I'm just asking. And I understand where you're at. This is more just a process thing. I think that by us actually adopting the report, because the division report's in front of us now. It's in the jurisdiction of this committee. We're going to be asked to adopt that, which to me seems a bit premature until we've actually walked through it and heard it and had some back and forth discussion. So to me, it just seems like we're jumping the gun on actually taking the vote because, you know, maybe based on it, and I do have some concerns, you know, a motion to not adopt it may just as well be in order until we've heard it through. So that's why I'm asking. All I'm asking is, can we hold off on the vote until we've actually walked through it? I don't think it's going to change anything, but just give us a chance to listen.
Well, Representative Krishan, I think you and I have a different understanding of the parliamentary procedure here. For instance, in Ways and Means, when a bill comes out of a division, the first motion is to adopt the division report. That's not to the substance of the bill. That's to the mechanics of bringing the bill before the committee so that we can then discuss it. Then after that, there is a motion to do whatever with the bill, and that's then to the substance of the bill. So this is simply bringing the Early Childhood Finance and Division Finance and Policy Division report before the committee. Representative Krishan.
Okay, and I don't need to split hairs, but if the parliamentary interpretation is a little bit different, why would we, by making the motion, that should make the bill come up? Correct?
Correct.
And so the motion to adopt would be to accept it, yes or no. So how can I accept something that I haven't vetted?
Because, Representative Krishan, you're accepting the fact that it exists.
But and by making the motion, the existence of it. And maybe we're getting existentialism. And I don't,
We're out there. Yeah, the way I'm understanding it, and this might be a little Robert's Rules of Order, so I should stop it right now, is we cannot, but it's true under Mason's as well, we can't discuss something that isn't before us.
But you made that motion.
And now we accept that it is before us, Chair Pinto reviews it, you will not be asked to vote on the bill itself today. We're just bringing it before the body. It being, yes, the division report. I know that we've discussed this with Mr. McCormick in House Nonpartisan, and he has said this is the process that we should use.
Okay, and so just to make it clear, I mean, we're going to, this isn't going to change the fact that it's still going to end up in the delete all and all that. I get all that. I just want to make sure procedurally with the new structure of the divisions. So essentially what we've done is this isn't necessarily like a bill where you would bring it up, we discuss it, choose to lay it over and all that. We've now taken that away. We're going to adopt this report one way or the other. I mean, it's going to happen.
I think what we're doing is we're adopting the division report into our committee for us to then be able to work with.
Okay. So last
thing.
This
is different than opinions people may have on what we do with it when we work with it.
So let me ask this, and then just so by adopting the division report, does that mean we as a committee agree or disagree with the division report? And could that be, I mean, like, so let's say there was something egregious or there was a mistake in it, and we all voted to adopt it. Would somebody look back on that and say, well, you must have agreed with it, you voted for it?
We are agreeing that the division report exists.
Okay.
We are withholding opinion on the substance of the division report. We are simply agreeing that it exists before this committee.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that's a bit vague. I understand that, but I mean, if I just think through of other examples, and I know we've spent a little bit of time on this, but again, what does our vote mean? That we're agreeing that it exists? We already know it exists. You've moved it. So the agreement of the adoption to me seems, if I vote in the affirmative of that, I'm voting to adopt that division report as opposed to just acknowledging it exists.
Chair Pinto, it is your division report we're discussing.
It is indeed, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kreisha. I think, if I understand this right, that what's happening is that this body is simply accepting that its subordinate body took this action. If you voted against this, it would be saying that there was some sort of procedural imperfection below, some way in which the process of producing the report was problematic. I may be going a little bit out on a limb here, but I think that may be right. Accepting the division report simply says, we acknowledge that our subdivision essentially did in fact produce this report. We are receiving the report. We are accepting it as the action of that body. We may hate it, right? We may think it's a horrible thing. Who knows? I certainly hope you don't. But that's a separate issue as to simply receiving it and saying that our subordinate body did, in fact, take this action. We acknowledge that they did, and we are accepting that action was taken by our subordinate body. I think that would be a distinction that would make sense to me anyway, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Chair, and then I'll move on. So as a point of compromise, could we just send an email to Mr. McCormick and say, what exactly will our vote be? Hold on. The vote's going to be the same. You're going to get the same outcome. I just would like everyone to be absolutely clear on what that affirmative vote will mean for them one way or the other. And, I mean, you can call it at any time. I just would like that clarification before we actually do it. And, again, I don't think it's going to change the outcome.
All right. Ms. Burt will confirm with
thank you.
Mr. McCormick, and hopefully he's on his email right now.
Yeah, and my last one, I just want to make sure, because we are accepting the recommendation, as I understand, with an affirmative vote, and that's what I want to be clear on. Are we accepting the recommendation of Chair Pinto's division report? Because that's an important distinction. But
all right.
That's the question in my mind.
So, to review, welcome, Chair Pinto. There's a motion before us to accept your division report. Can you please speak to the report?
I certainly can, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you so much for having me. And I want to acknowledge the presence on your division of several of the members of the Early Childhood Division. We've got Representative Damuth here, Representative Pryor, and then the Vice Chair, Representative Katiza Witoon. And we had a very productive couple months of work, working under this division. And what you have before you, House File 2610, represents the education portion of the division report. I do want to note that there's a separate division report that's gone to Health and Human Services. Our division was established really in recognition of the arc of little kids' lives and from birth all the way up to school, and so reporting to both of the divisions. So House File 2610, I'm just going to walk through a few highlights. I certainly have members wish we could ask House Research to walk through section by section, members or if the chair wishes to do so. Let me think. So perhaps I'll, if it looks like they're prepared to do so. So, Mr. Chair, perhaps we can do that first, and then I'll provide some highlights once we've walked through each section by section.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Ms. Parra?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Also, I'm just going to walk through it. One thing I'll note is one of the changes that the bill makes is it makes the school readiness plus spots permanent, and there are a few sections that relate to that, so I'll highlight those as we go. Section 1 of the bill modifies the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act. It prohibits a school district or charter school from dismissing a child participating or enrolled in a pre-kindergarten program. And just for reference, dismissal under the statute is defined as the denial of a current educational program to any pupil, and excludes exclusion, expulsion, and suspension. It does not include a removal. Section 2 requires a person providing instruction in a school district or charter school preschool, school readiness plus pre-K, or early ed program to meet the teacher licensure requirements that apply to K-12 teachers, but it also has an exemption for a teacher who is teaching in this school year, so that licensure requirement wouldn't apply until July 1, 2024. But all those teachers would still be included in the teacher's bargaining unit under PELRA. Section 3 clarifies the cognitive and social skills formative measurements administered to pre-K pupils in a VPK program, in a voluntary pre-kindergarten program, have to be age-appropriate. Section 4 clarifies that an eligible 4-year-old child served in a mixed delivery system may be charged a fee as long as the mixed delivery partner was not awarded a mixed delivery funded seat for that child. Section 5, there are currently four regions that are used for the application for VPK. And so this splits Minneapolis and St. Paul into separate regions. It doesn't affect funding for the other regions. Section 6, this is one of the school readiness plus provisions I was talking about. So it sets the combined count of participants for voluntary pre-kindergarten and school readiness plus at 7,160 annually on an ongoing basis. Under current law, that number would drop from 7160 to 3160. So this prevents those approximately 4,000 slots from expiring. Section 7 makes a couple of changes. One, it modifies the early learning scholarship income verification requirements, so it doesn't apply to certain children. And paragraphs B and C lower the scholarship age eligibility to be from birth to age 3. Currently, the recipient has to be 3 or 4 with some exceptions, so this lowers the age. But there is an exception for the sibling of a scholarship recipient, and that sibling can be age 4. And there's also an exception for a recipient who had previously received a scholarship until that child becomes eligible for kindergarten. Section 8, paragraph C eliminates the cap on the number of scholarships distributed through pathway 2 to the program sites. That limit was put in place in 2017, and so the language is eliminating that cap. And then paragraph E clarifies that a child receiving a scholarship has to receive the early learning developmental screening within 90 days of turning 3 years old, so they wouldn't have to take the screening before that age. Section 9 removes an obsolete provision that allowed an early scholarship pilot site to participate in the statewide program before it was rated through Parent Aware. Section 10 creates an early learning scholarship account in the Special Revenue Fund and transfers all the appropriations from the scholarships into the account and annually appropriates the money to the commissioner So this allows a carry forward of unspent funds, which means that if there aren't any unspent funds, those will not cancel back to the general fund. And it makes $950,000 annually available to the department for administrative costs. Sections 12 and 13 both relate to background studies. Section 12 allows tribal organizations to contract with DHS to conduct the background studies, and Section 13 allows Head Start programs to contract with DHS for those studies. Section 14, that's another change relating to the School Readiness Plus. It amends the session law to get rid of that expiration date. Section 15 requires the Department of Education and Department of Human Services to jointly provide a report on enhancing coordination between the CCAP program and the scholarship program. That would be due February 15, 2020. And then we have the appropriations, which I would let Ms. Adrians talk about.
Mr. Chair and members, if you like, I have incorporated all of the appropriations that came from Representative Pinto's Early Childhood Division report, and they are in the spreadsheet that I will walk through, so I can point them out as I go through that if you prefer.
I was reading the summary and listening to Ms. Perro. You had a question?
Mr. Chair, please. So the funding changes that came from the Early Childhood Division report have been incorporated into the spreadsheet that reflects everything in the DE amendment that we'll walk through in just a minute. But this might be a good chance to point out, you all have a one-page document in your somewhere in your papers, and this is a page of just the change items. So I'll quickly just point out where the early childhood provisions are on this. So if you will look at line 17, this is the college savings account pilot program, and the funding amount is $250,000 per year just in the first biennium. Then on line 22, this is the additional funding for the early childhood scholarships. So there was additional funding in Representative Pinto's bill of $12 million in the first biennium, and then it was increased just a bit in the education finance bill as well. So that's why that number is a little bit higher. On line 40, the Metro Deaf Charter School grants, it's $100,000 per year, and that's ongoing funding. On line 46, Reach Out and Read Minnesota is a program that is funded just in the first biennium. It's $105,000 in the first year and then $100,000 in the second year. And then the voluntary pre-K provision is on line 63, and this is the total cost to maintain the existing slots that Ms. Perro referred to. And the cost of that in the first biennium is $47 million, and in the second biennium it's just over $57 million. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Pinto, you had you wanted to follow with some comments.
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And members, I want to highlight a couple things. So one thing, a number of the sections referenced by Ms. Perro are sections that were in the language that was in the bill that passed both bodies last spring and ended up being vetoed by the governor. So there were a number of the provisions that are in this bill that were approved that didn't make it through last year, but we want to make sure to include them. Those are a number of the provisions in the middle. I wanted to highlight as well. Ms. Adrians walked through a number of the appropriations for some really exciting programs that will be funded through this proposal, Reach Out and Read, the Metro Deaf Charter School, the College Savings Accounts. And I want to point out that that program, the plan is to expand that to be statewide and be available for children throughout the state. There's amazing research showing that even a tiny amount of money at the beginning of life can make a big difference for family, even family employment and success for the family in the first couple years, certainly in school success all the way along. And then I do want to highlight making sure that I think it's about 4,000 children in the School Readiness Plus program being able to continue to have districts not lose those pre-kindergarten slots, but then also funding for the early learning scholarships, aiming them for the younger years, which we had a lot of information in our division about the importance of those very earliest years with brain development being 90% complete by age 3. So very excited about those points as well. And then really just one thing that I want to make sure to highlight is the plan for report on coordinating these programs, which is kind of in the middle of the bill. But recognizing that between voluntary pre-K and School Readiness Plus, early learning scholarships, we've got child care assistance program, et cetera. We had a report from Legislative Auditor last year on the need for more coordination, and we want to be driving towards that, and this report seems like an important step to doing so. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think I'm done for presenting the division report, and I'm pleased to be sharing with you.
Thank you very much, Chair Pinto. Questions?
Yes.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing me to ask the procedural thing, and I think I saw Mr. McCormick in. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you why I asked those questions. I, as you know, Representative Pinto, you've done good work in this area. I thank you. I want to start there. However, I've also done a lot in child protection, as you have. Here is, and I want you to look closely at this because I want to make sure we get this right, on line 7.18, I know why you're doing this, because I've also tried to do this in other bills, and that is you're taking the income verifications out earlier in line 7.6 to 7.7, and then here we say a child in need of protective services or foster care, which is the right thing and noble because we're trying to get to certain kids which we know are at the lower end of the spectrum, and we want to get them developmentally caught up. Here's my concern and why I couldn't vote for this report, at least until I had clarification. As you know, Representative Moran has House File 342, which is the American Family Preservation Act, which is going to substantially change how children in minority groups, specifically African American, will receive child protection services. So until I understand what changes are there, my concern is there could be a whole group of kids that, because of statute and status change, would lose out on this. And I'm worried that the intersection of those two, without understanding the implications, because as I understand the American Family Preservation, we're trying to change in statute 626 how families interact with the child protection services, and we may even be loosening those again because there are beliefs that we're too heavy-handed. My worry, and this is, like I said, my concern in this is if we draw a Venn diagram, that we now will eliminate a large group of children that we've been trying to get to forever because the ramifications of this and that bill haven't been fully, we don't know them yet. And so I'm just raising that to you because I would hate for us to pass this with these recommendations, pass House File 342, and then a year from now we're going, uh-oh, we have a whole group of African-American children that are falling through the cracks because these two intersect in a way that we didn't expect.
Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and Representative Kreisha, I know you've been a real leader in this area, and we have partners on it. And so thank you, and thank you for highlighting that issue in general, child protection. I guess I'd point out, though, that this division report doesn't make any change on what you're describing, right? So if lines 7.18 and 7.19, 7.20 don't go in, well, then we're just left with line, the original line 7.17. And so I guess I don't see any difference when it comes to protective services. So, and I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe this language was part of the language passed last spring as part of the, I don't want to use the, use any particular term for it, but the bill that passed the two houses. So, but I guess I don't see any difference in this division report on that, because if this division report didn't go through, then we'd just be left with line 7.17, which again references in need of protective services, and the language that we have is in need of protective services. I don't see any change to that.
Representative Krisha.
And so let me be clear that you're right, but the difference is House File 342 is moving through that will change Child Protective Services and the definitions for African-American children. That's the way that bill handles. That will change this. And so here's my question to you. I am now being asked to vote on something that I have worked hard not to do, which is eliminate certain groups of kids from getting into early childhood programs. That's why this vote is very important to me, because if House 342 passes and this language is still in there, which I agree with this language, but House 342 changes that, I am now going against what I have fundamentally fought against, and I don't want that to be reflected in my vote. That's why I'm bringing this up.
Mr. Chair Pinto,
I'll be real quick, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
I may need to talk with Representative Krisha about this offline, because when I look at, if we were just voting on 7.17, 7.20, what you brought up, I guess I don't see how what Representative Krisha is describing. It seems to me either way, he's in the same boat. It doesn't matter whether it's a yes or no with respect to House File 342, but we may just need to connect separately on that, I think, and make sure I may be misunderstanding where he's coming from, Mr. Chair, Representative Krisha.
Chair Pinto and Representative Krisha, I'm wondering if this is a good time to bring Mr. McCormick down to help clarify the parliamentary procedure.
Sure.
Mr. McCormick, if you would, please. Mr. McCormick, thank you for coming down. I believe the question is, and Representative Krisha, correct me if I'm mischaracterizing it, what is a member doing when they vote to accept the division report?
Madam Chair, members, when a member accepts the division report, they are accepting the bill and the amendments put on by division and putting it before this body, the full K-12 finance division, and making it available for further amendments.
Representative Krisha?
And so, thank you, Mr. Chair. And what does accept mean? Does that mean someone could construe that and interpret it as I'm accepting the language of that division report?
Mr. McCormick.
Madam Chair, Representative Krisha, yes. And so, therefore, if you do not, Mr. Chair, if you do not support the work of the division, you should vote against it.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McCormick. Other member questions? With that, the chair renews his motion to approve the Early Childhood Division Report, also known as the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee Division Report. Any discussion to the amendment, to the motion? Seeing Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So why can it already be incorporated in the omnibus bill if it hadn't been adopted yet?
Mr. Strong?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, the amendment in front of you is, like many past delete all amendments to the K-12 bill, where either individual articles are offered or a whole entire delete all is in front of the division, and that may include bills that are in possession of this committee or bills that are not in possession of this committee. Sometimes bills have been sent out of this committee and are still included in the omnibus the proposed amendment to the omnibus report.
Representative Erickson, I know that Mr. Withers is Ms. Burt kept Mr. Withers in knowledgeable about this process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Any other discussion of the motion?
Just my final comment.
Representative Krisha, please.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to call for a roll call. This is problematic, though, please. And what I would ask is let's let this go. You know, however people are going to vote, I'm going to vote against it just because I need to know that's clarified. It's still going to end up, and I hope we can fix it in the omnibus bill, and I'm sure we can look at it and fully understand the ramifications, because that's where that's at for me.
Thank you very much. With that, all those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay, next we are going to do an informational walkthrough of the DE amendment to House File 2400. We'll be taking questions from members once the walkthrough is complete, and then we'll move on to public testimony. Chair Devney, I understand that there are some last-minute fiscal adjustments to the bill. Members, before you, you should have a copy of an amendment that will be offered as an author's amendment on Thursday when we formally move the bill before the committee. House Research will review the informational amendment now.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Chair Devney.
Madam Chair, let me just start by particularly expressing my gratitude to the nonpartisan staff and all the work that they have done, as well as the staff that I have the benefit of, that I benefit from. They put in a mountain of work. Some of them actually sent their family out of state in order for this to happen. This being the first time I've been through this, it is a remarkable effort and with some astounding staff. So my gratitude to the nonpartisan staff for all the work they've done, as well as the committee staff. Thank you all.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, committee members, what's in front of you is an informational amendment that, if adopted, would bring the DE amendment into line with the fiscal tracking sheet that Ms. Adrians is going to speak to next. Essentially, the adjustments here reflect the final financial decisions that the chair is bringing forward in the delete all amendment. This will be as part of a separate amendment, as was said on Thursday, but for now is informational to let folks know how the bill ties out to the financial tracking sheets that Ms. Adrian says.
To your bill or amendment to the DE.
To the DE. I'm wondering if staff can assist in walking through the whichever way you want to start.
Madam Chair and members, if everyone is ready to talk about the numbers, as I said, you have a one-page document that shows just the change items in much bigger, nicer print than the spreadsheet that I'm going to walk through right now. So it's just a nice reference. And as Mr. Strom said, both the one-page and the five-page spreadsheet, what they reflect are the items that are in the DE1 amendment, the A3 amendment that was just referenced, and then the early childhood division report. And also, if you have these rulers in your folders, they're sometimes helpful to go through, and I didn't bring any magnifying glasses, so please ask questions later if I go over things a little bit too quickly. But what I'd like to touch on are the change items that do show up in the spreadsheet. So everything that I tried to italicize programs, if it is something that changes in the program heading, and then also a nice way to quickly pick out things that changed, the columns that are shaded in like a dark gray, these are the difference between the House recommendations way over on the right-hand side, and then also the difference between the governor and the base recommendations. So if there is a positive or negative number in this difference column, that means that that is a change. So if we could start at the very top in the general education area. So the first thing is the formula allowance change. You can see on line 13, this is the same as the governor's recommendation. It increases the per pupil allowance in fiscal year 2020 to $6,501. And then in 2021, it's an increase to $6,631. And this is when we reference this as a 3% increase and a 2% increase. So then ongoing in the tails, the per pupil amount is $6,631. And then on line 20, this is also a governor's recommendation. It's an ADM change for kindergarten And the cost here is $202,000 in the first biennium and $214,000 in the tails. On line 21, the early middle college program, the bill that was heard in committee last week, this cost in the first biennium is $136,000 and then $144,000 ongoing. On line 22, English learner revenue, this is an increase to that program. The amount in the first biennium is just over $4.4 million and then $4.7 million in the tails. On line 23, this is the bulk of where the cost for increasing the formula allowance by 3 and 2 shows up. It also is distributed among a few other program lines, and I'll point those out as we get to them. But the majority of the cost in the first biennium is almost $515 million, and then in the tails, almost $696 million. On line 24, this is a provision for operating referendum equalization, and the cost in the first biennium is $22.5 million and then $50 million in the tails. On line 25, this is the provision to maintain the existing slots for voluntary pre-K and school readiness plus from Representative Pinto's early childhood division report. And again, this is the bulk of the cost for that program, and it also is distributed among a couple of other programs as well, so you'll see those. But it's just over $41 million in the first biennium and then over $51 million in the tails. Now, members, if you'll move down to line 33, this is a provision to increase career and technical equalization aid. It starts in the second year of the first biennium, so the increase is just over $12 million, and then in the tails, the increase is $27 million. On line 37, this is, and on 39, there's a small increase because the non-public pupil education aid and the non-public pupil transportation aid are both linked to the formula, so if the formula increases, those two programs increase a bit as well. On line 47, this was the governor's provision to increase the achievement and integration aid levy. And so the cost of that is $345,000 in the first biennium and then $373,000 in the tails. Right below there, this is another program that if voluntary pre-K is increased, it ties to that and increases a bit as well. On line 50, this is a provision in the delete all. It's new. It's the after-school community learning program, and it is funded at $2 million per year in the first biennium and then $2.5 million each year in the tails. On line 53, the QComp program increases a bit when voluntary pre-K increases. On line 56, this is a provision for American Indian Teacher Preparation Grants. And the funding for this is just over $1 million each year for a total of $1.2 million for each biennium. Yes, this was in the base and it's been increased a bit. On line 58, there are just a few programs where they had funding that would cancel to the general fund. So in the delete all report, the programs, the funding is canceled and then reappropriated to that same program. So the net cost to the committee's target is zero. And the certificate incentive program, so the amount that was canceled and then reappropriated is $860,000 only in 2020. On line 59, the civics education grants receives $125,000 per year. The charter school building lease aid also has a small increase for the voluntary pre-K increase. On line 62, this is, we call it the Q program. It's the Collaborative Urban and Greater Minnesota Educators of Color Grants. It is not eliminated, but the proposal is to transfer it to a special revenue fund. So that funding line you will see lower on another page in the spreadsheet. It did receive additional funding, and I'll speak to that in just a minute. on line 64. This is a provision, hiring bonuses to try to recruit teachers to come teach in Minnesota. The proposal is just over $1 million each year. On line 65, the concurrent enrollment program receives an increase over its base funding of $6 million in the first biennium and then $8 million in the second. On line, let's see, the next change, on line 73, the governor recommended funding for full-service community schools, and the House recommendation will be to do $7.5 million in the first biennium each year, and then increase that to $12.5 million per year in the tails. On line 75 is the Girl Scouts program, the Girl Scouts Connect Z program. This is funded in the first biennium only at $1.4 million per year. On line 76, Inclusive School Enhancement Grants. This is funding of $2.5 million per year in the first biennium, and then it's increased a bit to $3 million in the tails each year. And then if you would go to the second page. There are a number of, a couple of new funding provisions. The Minnesota Center for the Book, there was funding previously, but it was put into the base at $125,000 per year ongoing. The Minnesota Council on Economic Education, this is funded at $500,000 per year, and it's a new program. On line 82, the Minnesota Math Corps program, this is an increase over base. The increase is $1 million. In the first biennium. On line 83, the Minnesota Principals Academy, the increase over the base is an additional $50,000 per year ongoing. On line 84, this is a new funding for the Minnesota Youth Council of $250,000 ongoing per year. For the museum and education centers, the change in funding for these programs are on lines 91, 92, and 93. And just as a note, it looks like they're negative numbers, but they're actually in brackets. And so what that does in the spreadsheet is it doesn't change all the other totals. So I just wanted you all to be able to see the amount that each museum receives under the Museum and Education Center's funding. So the total total amount that we appropriate for the museums will be $591,000 per year, and of that amount, the new funding amounts are for the Children's Discovery Museum in Grand Rapids. That will be $31,000 per year. The Children's Discovery Museum of Southern Minnesota in Mankato, they will receive $50,000 each year, and then the Works Museum in Bloomington, and they will receive $50,000 per year. On line 94, the Northwest Regional Partnership, this is another one of those cancellation of funds for the 18-19 biennium, and then they are reappropriated in fiscal year 2020. It's $1 million. On line 95, the paraprofessional pathway to licensure, the increase over base and funding is an additional $7 million in the first and second biennium. On line 97, this is a bill we heard to provide training for special ed paraprofessionals and related staff. And the cost is each year just over $7 million. On line 103, this is the proposal to provide services for Serve Minnesota at tribal contract and grant schools. The amount of funding is $416,000 per year. On line 106, the statewide concurrent enrollment training program, it's another cancellation and reappropriation program. So the canceled and reappropriated money is $400,000. And then that's just in the 1 year, and their ongoing base is $375,000 per year. On line 108, this was a governor's recommendation to eliminate off-grade questions. And there is what these are. These are test questions that are given to students based on how they did on the operational MCA tests. And so to remove them, and removing them was a recommendation from an OLA study that was done. So it would provide a one-time savings due to decreased test construction and statistical analysis that would need to be done on the tests. So it's just a one-time savings of $15,000. On line 111, this was also a governor's provision to support students experiencing homelessness. So the appropriation would be $500,000 each year. On lines 112 and 113, these are both teachers of color provision. The first line is for recruitment and retention. The funding would be $1.5 million in the first 2 years and then $2 million ongoing after that. And the report is every other year, so it's $15,000 in the year that the report is to be performed. So one time in the first biennium and then one time in the second biennium. On line 116, this was the governor's proposal to continue funding for the tribal contract schools at the 2019 level rather than have it decrease to a lowered level in 2020. So the cost to do that is $3.5 million in the first biennium and then $4.6 in the second. On line 117, the Tribal Nations Education Committee, this was also a governor's proposal, and it's $150,000 each year. On line 119, this is a grant for vocational enrichment, and this would be $100,000 each year and to focus on the construction and the welding trades. On line under special education, if you'll move down there, the change starts on line 129. So this bill takes the governor's proposal for funding increase in reform provisions and then adds a little bit more on top of that. And the spending is $117 million in the first biennium and then $173 million in the second biennium. Voluntary pre-K has some interaction with special education, so there's a bit of funding for that. And then on line 131, this is supplemental aid for special ed situations that happened in previous years for both Duluth and Monticello. Monticello would receive $200,000 each year, and Duluth would receive $1 million in additional special ed aid each year. The health and safety provisions begin on line 136. The Safe Schools Aid, this is the same recommendation as the governor, but the governor paid for the increase with both aid and levy. And so the House provision is a bit more expensive because it's being paid for entirely with aid. And so the cost is just over $24 million in the first biennium and almost $39 million in the tails. And built into that line number is additional funding for charter schools to come up to the district school level as well. Support our students is funded at $5 million a year. On line 138, this is for training and compliance for Title IX. And the cost is $292,000 in the first biennium and $294,000 in the second. Innovative mental health grants for intermediates and level four schools sites is $2.7 million each year. And then trauma-informed school incentive aid, this was a bill we heard last week of Representative Moran's, and the funding is $3 million each year ongoing. The next page, under facilities and technology, long-term facilities maintenance revenue has interaction with voluntary pre-K, so there's an increased cost for that. And then on line 149, there's additional long-term facilities maintenance aid for the cooperatives, and that cost starts in the second year of the biennium and is ongoing at $139,000 per year. And then Hopkins receives some additional money for levy options, and that starts in 2021 as well, and it's $50,000 ongoing. Online, under nutrition, school breakfast and school lunch both have interactions with voluntary pre-K with that formula, so they increase a bit along with that increase. And then on line 159, this is the breakfast after the bill that the committee heard, and the funding is for $4.3 million in the first biennium and then $5.8 million in the second biennium. On line 166, this is increased funding for libraries. The funding is $7.6 million in the first biennium and $8 million in the second biennium. And then down to early childhood, these are the numbers that I referenced before. These are all from the early childhood division report. Line 180 has the college savings account pilot program. Line 184 has the early learning scholarships. This also looks zeroed out, but this, because it's transferred to the special revenue fund, I'll point that out in just a minute. And then line 189 is the Metro Deaf Charter School grant, and line 192 has the Reach Out and Read Minnesota program. If you'll go to page 4. Under the Community Education and Prevention Programs, Education Partnership Programs received an increase of funding. The Tier 1 grants, these are the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood and NAS, those will receive an increase of $740,000 each biennium. And then the Tier 2 programs, they'll receive $1.26 million additional funding in each biennium. Mr. Storm and Ms. Perro will go through this in more detail, but it removes the competitive grant aspect, and then it just appropriates money to specific programs. On line 206, adult basic education aid, the increase is over base is $3.8 million in the first biennium and $4 million in the tails. There's additional reimbursement on line 207 for high school equivalency tests like GED tests, and the additional funding is $240,000 in each biennium. For the state agencies, these are all the governor's recommendations for increases. So MDE asked for additional funding for data analytics, litigation fees, a mainframe system update, maltreatment investigations, an operating adjustment, National Board Certified Teachers, more funding for regional centers for excellence, a second chance agency director, funding for turnaround art schools, which was previously funded through the Purpich Academy, and then there's an admin interaction with VPK. And so the additional for all those programs for the Minnesota Department of Education, it would be just under $16 million for the first biennium, and then $12.5 million in the tails. And then Pelsby, the provision is in the delete all bill is to move them to a special revenue educator licensure account, so there's no funding on the general fund line. And then the Minnesota State Academies, these increases are the governor recommended increases. So they requested additional funding to enhance services for an operating adjustment and a technology initiative as well. And their additional funding is $3.37 million in the first biennium and $3.27 million in the tails. And we're almost there. On the last page, Purpich, these are also the governor's recommended increases. They asked for additional funding for an operating adjustment and a technology initiative as well. And so in the first biennium, their additional funding would be $1.8 million and then just over $1.1 million in the tails. Then let me take you to the revenues, transfers, and cancellations portion before we get to the bottom line. This is where the collaborative, the Q grant program, and then the early learning scholarships show up on line 294 and 295. So the additional funding for the Q program would be $6 million in the first biennium and then $12 million in the tails over base. And then for the early learning scholarships, the additional funding would be that number, I believe, is wrong. So it's closer to $14 million additional in the first biennium and the second. I will correct that. Pelsby, we take the general fund money and transfer it out for the special revenue account. So on line 304, this is the total general fund, all of the changes for the E12 initiatives. And so the column that's the difference between House and the base for fiscal 18 and 19, this is the total of all of the cancellations. So it's a negative $4.26 million. And then That, along with the total change items for the difference between the house and the base for 20 and 21, that number is $904.26 million. So the net of the two numbers is an increase of $900 million over the base. And then in the tails, the increase over the base is just over $1.2 billion. And then right below that, the special revenue fund line, this is where the Board of School Administrators requested a fee revenue, and then also to be put in a separate special revenue account. So that is the administrator licensure account that you see on lines 310 and 311. And then this is just the spending the revenues that come in for all of the things that are in the special revenue accounts. And then under the appropriations and expenditures, this is then the spending for those same programs. So that nets out to zero. And Madam Chair, I think that's everything.
Thank you very much. Again, this is just an informational walkthrough. So, Mr. Chair, to your DE amendment.
Well, Madam Chair, I do feel like I need to point out the additional funding we provided, early learning scholarships for the state's youngest learners.
See this.
I'm wondering if Mr. Strom wants to walk through the summary to provide members more insight and context.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Daphne, yes, Ms. Pera and I will be glad to go through the summary. One other note, your levy target, your informal levy target is zero, and Ms. Adrians will have a separate sheet for you showing that levy target as zero, and then the addition of the $25 million of levy relief that the tax committee has asked you to make. So when the levy sheet is presented to you, you'll essentially see $25 million below the base levy for that year. Madam Chair, members, in front of you is the summary for the DE1. The summary should match the bill with the A3 amendment on it and match the spreadsheet as Ms. Adrians just presented. We'll try to go through this as quickly as possible for you. Many of the provisions in here are either from House File 2207, the governor's education funding bill, or have come from Representative Joachim's bill, House File 1711. The first two are two of three sections from Representative Lynn Carlson's bill that say if there's a state budget surplus in future years, that the additional shift that happens with special education funding would be eliminated. And individual authors may want to speak up when their provisions are heard for those that came into Representative Joachim's bill. Section 3, it has to do with the services, transportation services provided to homeless students, and designates the initial serving district as the district to maintain the transportation services throughout the year, even if the homeless child ends up in another district during the year. Section 4 is slightly rewritten from the language that left the policy committee on the enrollment of a student in foster care. And there'll be a second section later in this article with that as well. Section 5 was a provision from the policy bill. And again, you heard the policy bill the other day, absence from school for religious holidays. Section 6 is the calendaring requirement requiring the school board to consider religious observances when it determines its calendar. Section 7 and a few other sections in this article and in Article 2 all have to do with the shift to the lowering of the compulsory instruction age from 7 to 6. And this provision requires the district to provide kindergarten. Section 8 is simply technical changes. Sections 9, 10, and 11 all deal with textbooks. These were the bills that were brought to the Ed Policy Committee authorizing the textbook aid to be used for teacher's edition or teacher's guides when those are packaged with the regular student instructional manuals. Section 12 is from the governor's bill and requires a school board to take charge of and control all extracurricular activities. Under current law, there's an option for them not to do so. Section 13 is a provision that raises the CTE revenue. The current reimbursement is 35% of the district's eligible expenses from the previous year. This provision raises that to a 50% reimbursement of the district's previous year expenditures, and also changes the equalizing factor for the formula so that all of that increase in revenue comes as state aid. Section 14 increases the English learner basic revenue. Currently, that's $704 times the number of eligible English language learners in the district. That would go up by $36 per year starting in FY20. Section 15 and a number of other sections from here on out deal with the local optional revenue. Under current law, a school district, when they go to the voters to renew a referendum, needs to include in the amount any board-approved referendum amounts and any local optional revenue amounts. The governor's recommendation that is followed in this draft is to move those two items into local optional revenue and have those entirely separate from the referendum. So that when the district asks for a ballot question on a referendum, that it reflects simply the amount that would be in that category and not the $724 in local optional revenue. Section 16 makes two changes to the pupil units. First, and you'll see this same provision is repeated in Representative Pinto's early education provisions, makes the School Readiness Plus program pupils permanent, and it also adjusts for that small category of students in the disabled kindergarten pupils, puts them on the same hours of service for a full ADM as non-disabled kindergarten pupils. Section 17 raises the basic formula allowance by 3% the first year and by 2% in the second year and keeps it at that level in future years. Section 18 is just a cross-reference. Section 19 is another of the provisions related to local optional revenue. Section 20 eliminates a requirement that was put in place a couple of years ago regarding compensatory revenue. The requirement required a school district to reserve a portion of the compensatory revenue for extended time purposes. This section would eliminate that requirement starting in fiscal year 20. Section 21 adjusts the operating capital levy. This isn't a revenue effect, but it's an aid levy effect to adjust for some of the other provisions, primarily VPK, that changed the aid levy ratio by putting those pupil units back. Section 22 is simply a technical adjustment to the equity revenue provision. Section 23 is also related to the kindergarten and fees, and just makes clear that that there's no prohibition on using fees that don't otherwise exist, since all-day kindergarten is now free for all students. Sections 24 through 31 have to do with the referendum allowance, and there's two primary changes here outside of the rolling out of the local optional revenue. Those are, first of all, that the renewal can happen for future referendums if the ballot language of a future referendum allows board approval, that a renewal can occur by board action for future operating referendum. This is subject to a reverse referendum where a petition needs to be filed in order to trigger the reverse referendum. And the second change is the additional $25 million of referendum revenue reduction, of the levy reduction, and that's that should be in Section 27 of the bill. There should be a second sentence there that says that the equalizing factor has been increased, and as Ms. Adrian said on the spreadsheet walkthrough, the change in the equalizing factor will save will reduce that levy by about $25 million and increase the referendum aid accordingly. Section 32 is the reverse referendum that was mentioned that requires the petition to be filed by June 1st of each year if voters want to have a reverse referendum on the board approved authority, and requires 25% of the district's registered voters to sign the petition. Section 33 is from Representative Bennett through the omnibus policy bill, and requires that grant applicants go through an evidence-based process in the future. Section 34 and 35 make clarifying changes. Section 36 is the second section related to the foster care bill that was heard in the policy committee. This is an annual report that the Commissioner of Human Services prepares regarding foster students and adds to that report a requirement to report on the number of school enrollments that reoccur essentially within 7 days of a student being placed in a foster home. Section 37 adjusts the Labor Day start for 2 years only for calendar year, the 2021 school year and the 21-22 school year. It would allow school districts to start on August 31st instead of after Labor Day. Section 38 establishes the Transportation Working Group to examine the state's pupil transportation formula. Section 39 includes the appropriations for Article 1 that Ms. Adrian's just spoke of, and Section 40 is the last of the provisions related to the operating referendum and the separation of the local optional revenue. So, Madam Chair, in summary, that's Article 1.
Very good. Ms. Parra?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'll be going through Articles 2 and 3 before turning it back to Mr. Strom. Article 2, Education Excellence. Like the previous article, a lot of these provisions come from either the policy bill or from the governor's bill. Section 1 adds a school district or charter school students in foreign exchange programs to the statute that governs students in travel abroad programs. Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 all relate to the change in the age of compulsory instruction and that being lowered to begin at 6. Section 6 amends the World's Best Workforce Plan requirements. Section 6 and 7 are both from the Teacher of Color Bill and were in the Policy Bill, and that relate both of those relate to changes to require that environments be more inclusive and respectful and retaining diverse effective teachers. Section 8 requires the school district to screen for characteristics of dyslexia all students identified as not reading at grade level with the end of kindergarten grade 1 and 2 and to screen students in grade 3 or higher who demonstrate a reading difficulty unless a different reason for the difficulty has been identified. Sections 9, 10, 11, and 12 are all from the governor's bill relating to statewide testing. Section 9 removes the requirement that the commissioner empirically derive benchmarks on adaptive assessments and disseminate the computer adaptive tests. Section 10 eliminates definitions related to the off-grade testing requirements. That's again where the student would see items on a test that were for a lower grade or higher grade. Those are being eliminated. Section 11 redefines the growth measure for the testing, and Section 12 modifies the school performance reports to report academic progress consistent with federal expectations. Sections 13 through 21 are all student discipline provisions that were in the policy bill. One change is to define non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices, and then those are required. That term is then used in a number of those other sections. There's also a definition of pupil withdrawal agreements. And there are changes relating to the provision of alternative agreements, requiring the district to use non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices before the dismissal, requiring that alternative education services be provided when a student is suspended for more than five consecutive school days, requiring suspended students be given a reasonable opportunity to complete schoolwork during the suspension, requirements relating to the written notice of an intent to exclude or expel, requiring that the admission or readmission plan address measures to improve the pupil's behavior. A school board is requiring the school board to report pupil withdrawal agreements and the non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices given to the pupil in response to an assault, and modifying the policies, the disciplinary policies that a district has to adopt. Section 22 relates to student journalism. It adopts a definition of several definitions, including a definition of student journalist and student media advisor. It provides certain protected conduct for a student journalist and provides protection for a student media advisor who supports a student journalist exercising free speech rights. Section 23 relates to the change in compulsory instruction requiring a school board to provide kindergarten free of charge to all eligible children in the district. Section 24 modifies the accreditation requirement for an Opportunities Industrialization Center that relates to the post-secondary enrollment options. Section 25 requires a school district to notify a student of PSEO opportunities by a certain date. Section 26 makes technical corrections. Section 27 modifies, this relates to after-school community learning programs. It modifies the qualifications for organizations that can receive grants under this section, as well as the grant proposal requirements, and requires the commissioner to monitor and evaluate recipients' performance and provide some technical assistance. Section 28 is from the governor's bill, and it makes changes to the full-service community schools. It adds some definitions, including a community-wide full-service community school leadership team, establishes grant amounts at $100,000 for up to 1 year for planning purposes and $150,000 annually each year thereafter. Sections 29 to 34 were from the policy bill, and that's a technical change, changing vocational or school to work to career and technical. Sections 35 and 36 were from the bill we heard last year, the students with limited or interrupted formal education, and making permanent the ability of an early middle college program to serve a student who is not yet 22 years old. Section 37 requires that an American Indian Education Parent Advisory Committee submit its reasons for non-concurrence directly to the school board. Section 38 increases tribal contract aid amount for fiscal years 2020 and later to the 2019 amount. Under current law, this was said to, under current law, the allowance is $32.34 per pupil for fiscal years 2015 to 19, and that without this change, that would have fallen back to $1,500 per pupil for fiscal years 2020. This provision also links future amounts to increases in the basic formula allowance. Section 39 clarifies how administrative expenses are removed from the Achievement and Integration Program funding. Section 40 redefines achievement and integration aid to include an equalization aid component. This was all from the governor's bill. Section 41 equalizes the achievement and integration levy. It sets the equalizing factor equal to 30% of the statewide adjusted net tax capacity per pupil unit. Section 42 defines the achievement and integration equalization aid as the difference between equalized revenue and levy. Sections 43 and 44 relate to the Minnesota Youth Council Committee modifying eligibility for membership and allowing them to receive an annual state appropriation to fund the Minnesota Youth Council. Section 45 defines medium and high growth for purposes of the Literacy Incentive Aid Program. Section 46 requires an affiliated nonprofit building corporation to serve no more than one charter school. Sections 47 and 48 go together. The first requires that a paraprofessional working with a student with disabilities be given paid time to review a student's individualized education program or be briefed on the specific needs. And so that that paraprofessional would have to have at least 8 hours of paid time. And that would have to be either before the first instructional day of the year or within 30 days of hire. And then Section 48 establishes that paraprofessional training aid that's equal to $200 per paraprofessional, so it's done on a headcount basis. Sections 49 and 50 are the certification incentive revenue that Ms. Adrian's referenced earlier. It would extend the program's existing funding through the fiscal year 2020. So it cancels a portion of the 2017 appropriation, and then that's reappropriated for fiscal year 2020. Sections 51 and 52 are from the governor's bill. The first is the Innovation Research Zones pilot program, which allows schools to get exemptions from certain statutes and rules. Section 52 is the Rural Career and Technical Education Consortium Grant Program, defining consortium characteristics and requiring grants to specific consortia. Section 53 establishes a vocational enrichment program for programs that operate outside the regular school days, and prioritizes grants for welding and construction programs. Section 54 is the Breckenridge bill that we heard, I believe, last week, allowing the Breckenridge School District to enter into an agreement with a post-secondary education institution in North Dakota. Section 55 is the appropriations that Ms. Adrian's walked you through. And Section 56 repeals statutory definitions related to testing. Those were from the governor's bill.
Thank you, Ms. Pera. Well, I'll take a deep breath and jump into Article 3. Mr. Strom. Oh, you still get, oh, okay. I will take a deep breath and continue with Article 3. Ms. Pera.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Article 3 is the teacher article. And many of these provisions are from, again, the policy bill or the governor's bill. There are also some provisions from the teacher of color bill that was House File 824. Sections 1 and 2 are both from the teacher of color and American Indian teacher bill. So for the first section establishes inclusive school enhancement grants for programs to make a school climate and curriculum more inclusive and respectful. Section 2 establishes a goal of increasing the percentage of teachers who are of color or American Indian by at least 2 percentage points each year in order to have a teaching workforce that more closely reflects the state student population and ensure all students have access to effective and diverse teachers by 2040. And it requires some reporting by Pelsby on progress towards this goal. Section 3 moves the code of ethics for teachers. That's currently that's in rule, and this moves it to statute. Sections 4 through 7, those are changes relating to definitions of teacher and field and teacher preparation program. Section 7 includes it within teacher preparation programs, post-secondary institutions and alternative providers. Sections 8 and 9 relate to the number of members that should be in Pelsby, and it's slightly different from what was in the policy bill, which added 3 members. This adds 2 members and also makes a corresponding change to the board composition, so in order to keep an odd number of members on the committee. Section 10 eliminates the requirement that the department provide office space to Pelsby. Section 11 prohibits the public employer of a member of Pelsby from reducing the member's compensation while the member is on board business. Section 12 requires Pelsby to adopt rules relating to alternative teacher prep programs. Section 13 is a technical change. Sections 14 and 15 make reading strategies and technology strategies requirement applicable to all program providers. Section 16 eliminates obsolete language. Section 17 eliminates the requirement that a background check be performed by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Section 18 modifies the military license fee. Section 19 modifies the background check requirement. And eliminates language that allows Pelsby or BOSA to issue a license when the background check is still pending. Section 20, the language relating to licensure via portfolio fees is kind of being moved around in statute, so that's part of what you see there in Section 20. Section 21 limits a Tier 1 license to 1 renewal unless there's good cause for additional renewal. Section 22 allows Pelsby to under current law, Pelsby starts reviewing accepting applications for Tier 1 licenses after July 1. This allows them to accept certain applications before July 1. Section 23 allows a teacher with a Tier 1 license to be included in the teacher's bargaining unit. Section 24 eliminates the coursework requirements for Tier 2 candidates and modifies other eligibility requirements. Section 25 limits the Tier 2 license to 2 renewals. Section 26, as with Tier 1, it allows PELSB to accept certain applications before July 1. Section 27 eliminates language that, under current law, allows a teacher to obtain a Tier 3 license based on 3 years of teaching experience with a Tier 2 license without being placed on an improvement process. Section 28 modifies the mentorship requirement for a Tier 3 teacher. Section 4 eliminates the requirement that a candidate for a Tier 4 license prove that the candidate's most recent summative evaluation did not place that candidate on an improvement process. Section 30 modifies mentorship requirements for a Tier 4 license. Section 31 requires that an employing school district, allows an employing school district or employing school or district to verify the teacher's performance, to verify the teacher's skills in reading, writing, or math, rather than the teacher having to take an exam. And there is an error there that I will fix, but rather than requiring testing centers to provide monthly opportunities on the exams, the bill requires PELSB to analyze the use of untimed tests on the exams. Section 32 and 33 go together. So currently, teachers have to show professional growth, and that includes cultural competency. But a teacher can instead provide the teacher's summative evaluation to show professional growth. So these changes take the cultural competency portion out of the professional growth piece and requires the board to adopt separate rules requiring teachers renewing Tier 3 or 4 license to have cultural competency training. Section 34 requires PELSB to request a criminal history background check from the BCA on candidates applying for renewal licenses if they haven't had one in the previous 5 years. Section 35 allows the board to approve all teacher prep programs rather than only the ones at colleges or universities for purposes of licensing bilingual and ESL teachers. Section 36 relates to discipline for a teacher's license. What is different here from what was in the policy bill is that it allows PELSB or BOSET to issue non-disciplinary corrective action for certain violations that include things related to mental health or chemical dependency. That would apply when the violation does not meet the criteria for a suspension or a revocation. Section 37 adds certain folks to the mandatory reporting statute, so they would be required to report to PELSB. Section 38, again, relates to the portfolio fees requirements. Section 39 requires a superintendent or a charter school to provide to the school board the number of teachers in each school building with each tier of license. The difference between what is here and what was in the policy bill is rather than having MDE publish this data, PELSB now has to publish it. And the school district still has to do it. Section 40 includes ABE and ECFE teachers in the definition of teacher for purposes of continuing contracts and tenure. Sections 41 and 42 limit the placement of students in the classroom of a teacher with a Tier 1 or 2 license. Section 43 establishes a program to reimburse school districts that offer hiring bonuses for licensed teachers that are coming from out of state. Section 44 to 48 all relate to American Indian Teacher Preparation Grants. Those were from both the Governor's Bill and the Teacher of Color Bill. One key change there is removing student loans from the list of allowable uses for grants. Section 49 codifies the Collaborative Urban and Greater Minnesota Educators of Color grant program that's been funded over the years, but it's been in session law, so this is moving it to statute. It sets criteria for the grants, and it creates a Q account in the special revenue fund. Section 50 is Grow Your Own Pathways to Teacher Licensure Grants. This, again, has been funded, but previously it's been in session law, so this moves it to statute. It requires programs to provide scholarships or stipends to enable employees to participate in a non-conventional teacher preparation program. And it also allows certain entities to apply for new programs, for funding for new programs. It requires grants to be spent within 18 months of receipt. Section 51 modifies the mentorship statute. It encourages districts to develop mentoring programs and sets up some requirements for those mentoring programs. Section 52 expands the reporting requirements for PSEO grant recipients. Section 53 modifies the achievement and integration plan requirements to include recruitment and retention of certain staff, plans to include strategies to make curriculum and environments more inclusive. Section 54 adds BOSA to the definition of non-health-related licensing board for purposes of Chapter 214, which governs the operations of both health-related boards and non-health-related licensing boards. Section 55 allows the Commissioner of Human Services to contract with Pelsby for background study. Section 56 requires law enforcement to inform Pelsby or BOSA after determining that a licensee has maltreated a child, and requires law enforcement to work collaboratively with the board. Section 57 requires the Commissioner of Education to provide the investigative file in a determination of maltreatment involving a licensee to the licensing board, but the student's identifying information would be removed. Section 58, there's a list of offenses that if a court determines a person with a person licensed to teach has been convicted of, the court has to send a copy of the conviction to Pelsby or BOSA, and this provision expands that list of offenses. Section 59 and 60, that is another one of the cancellations that Ms. Adrian's referenced, this one relating to the concurrent enrollment teacher training program, canceling the appropriation and then reappropriating it. Section 61 is the grants for Pelsby to administer, and Section 62 is the programs and grants that MDE would administer, and Ms. Adrian's referenced those. And finally, Section 63 is the repealer. It repeals the session law relating to portfolio fees because, as I said, that's a technical change. Paragraph B is the course requirement for Tier 2 candidates. The Pelsby authorization to develop code of ethics, because again, that's being moved into statute, and the American Indian teacher loan provisions. It also repeals the rule relating to the teacher code of ethics.
Thank you, Ms. Parrott. Now, Mr. Strom, we'll let you take a go at it. Article 4.
Madam Chair, thank you. Article 4 is the special education article. Let me take just 2 minutes of time to describe what the House's funding changes were before we go through the bill summary. A few of the provisions in the special education area are written in a way that even is relatively impenetrable by the language. So essentially what the House is doing is starting with the governor's plan, then eliminating the per pupil cap in fiscal year 20, 1 year earlier than the governor. Second, going to a higher level of cross-subsidy aid up to 8.6% starting in fiscal year 21, so higher than the governor in the cross-subsidy aid. Third, including in each school district's each school district has an FY16 base that's inflated. To get to the last step of the special education formula. And two school districts by name, Monticello and Duluth, are given an adjustment to that FY16 base. So as that amount's brought forward, essentially their bases will reflect fiscal year 16 plus an adjustment. And then finally, the fourth change in the special education formula is to lower the unreimbursed costs that can be billed back from the serving school to the school districts. The House picks up the governor's recommendations for the district-to-district billbacks, but changes the charter school billbacks. And what the House provision in front of you does is, under current law, the charter school bills 90% of its unreimbursed costs back to the resident district. The governor recommended that the charter school bill 80%, starting in fiscal year 21, bill 80% back to the resident district and have the state pick up 10%. So that the relationship under the governor's bill was the charter was unchanged, the resident district had a 10 percentage point break, and the state would pay that amount to the charter school as part of the regular special ed formula. The House proposes in 21 and for fiscal year 20 to go down by 5% and fiscal year 21 by 10%, so that the total amount of the unreimbursed special ed amount that can be charged back by a charter school is 80%, not 90%. And continues the governor's approach of having 10% of that paid for by in state aid directly. So the net result under the House proposal in front of you is that the charters would bill back 80% of their unreimbursed cost, 10 percentage points would come from the state, and the remaining 70 percentage points of the unreimbursed cost would come from the resident school district. Those are the changes in the formula, so now let me briefly walk through each of the sections in Article 4. Section 1 is the adjustment for the charter school so that it's a 5% reduction in FY20 and a 10% reduction in 21. Section 2 eliminates the benchmarks or short-term allows the benchmarks or short-term objectives to be eliminated, the IEP team to eliminate those except for students who take alternative assessments, and allows the school district to conduct a functional behavioral assessment as a standalone evaluation. Section 3, also from the policy bill, has to do with alternative dispute resolution and requires the prior written notice to state that a parent who objects to a proposal or refusal in the notice may identify the specific part and request a meeting with the appropriate members of the IEP team. Section 4 is the same regarding conciliation conferences as what was in the policy bill. Section 5 is the provision with ADSIS, the alternative delivery of specialized instructional services, and allows a child who has a disability in one area to receive ADSIS services in another area that's not the student's primary disability area. Section 6 gets into the funding changes that I mentioned. One part of the governor's funding recommendation has to do with the current end of calculation hold harmless, which is the revenue for fiscal 16 brought forward, changed by ADM, and then inflated each year by 4.6%. This is essentially reestablishing that as bringing that forward to 2020, and then saying for each year thereafter, and I'm missing a zero here, for each year thereafter, the 4.6% goes down by 0.2%. So in the first year out after that, the guarantee would be 4.4%, the next year 4.2%, et cetera. So each year two thousandths of a percent essentially, or 0.2% of the total, or 0.2%, would be the reduction in that grandfather until that reaches a 2% increase each year. Section 7 establishes the special education initial aid. This amount adjusts the census variation, the census dollar amounts for each category of disability, and also changes the overall amounts slightly by a few dollars. And this one-third of the regular formula then would be slightly more expansive revenue-wise. Section 8 gets into the special ed reduction. As I mentioned earlier, the House sticks with the governor's recommendation that the district-to-district billbacks will be declining each year with no state aid involved for those that are essentially not in the 100% billback range. So that for district to district, that would drop from 90 to 85 to 80 to 75%. So eventually, essentially, a serving school district would be billing back to 75% of its unreimbursed costs to the resident district. And then the second part of that adjustment is the change in enrollment by the 4.6% per year. Section 9 is the new cross-subsidy aid. The aid amounts are set at 4.3% in the first year and then 8.6% in each subsequent year. So essentially, after all the special education calculations are made, the cross-subsidy is determined, and 8.6 of that would be paid in the cross-subsidy reduction aid. Section 10 gets into the another provision in the alternative attendance about the billing back to the resident school districts. You can see the percentage being lowered there from 85 in 2020 to 80% in 2021 and later. Sections 11 and 12 are part of the recodification of the intermediate school district statute, moving that back into the K-12 education code. Section 13 establishes a working group. The Commissioner of Education appoints the working group, and its charge is to make recommendations to improve the alignment between state guidance and federal law requirements on prior written notice. Section 14 requires the Commissioner of Education to amend its rules on special education to not require an IEP to report a student's performance or general state or district tests and assessments. Section 15 is the adjustment I mentioned at the beginning for the Duluth and Monticello school districts. This base adjustment works into the front end of the special education formula. And then, as Ms. Adrian's mentioned, in Section 16 in the appropriations section, there's also a line item appropriation, a second provision for each of these two districts that's on the worksheet. That's an annual amount in addition to the formula computed special ed revenue amounts for those two districts. The rest of Section 16 are the appropriations for Article 4. Section 17 is the last of the intermediate provision, or 17 and 18 are the last two intermediate provisions that help the recodification of that from the higher ed chapters of 136 to the K-12 chapters in the 120s.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Ms. Pera.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Article 5 is the health and safety article, and the first six sections are from the policy bill. The first encourages districts and charter schools to provide mental health instruction for students starting in the fourth grade. And one small change that you'll see here is that the resources that the Commissioner of Education has to make available are now resources gathered by national mental health advocates. Section 2 requires the commissioner to identify one or more model comprehensive sexual health education programs. And requires districts and charter schools to implement a comprehensive sexual health education program starting in the 2021-2022 school year. Section 3 requires the Department of Education to provide training, technical assistance, and other resources to school districts regarding sexual violence and Title IX, which is the federal statute relating to sexual discrimination in schools. Sections 4 and 5 relate to the administration of drugs and medicines in schools, and Section 5 has some requirements relating to the transport or disposition of unclaimed medicines. Section 6 allows a student to have and use sunscreen at school without a note from a health professional. Section 7 allows the school district's long-term facilities maintenance plan to include certain school safety improvements. And modifies the equalizing factor to adjust for other levy changes. Section 8 adds public announcement systems and certain other equipment related to violence prevention and facility security to the eligible purposes for capital equipment bonds. Under current law, the districts can count equipment revenue for purposes of computing the total amount of capital equipment bonds. And now under this law, under this section, district could also count its safe schools revenue for that purpose. Section 9 increases Safe Schools revenue. It increases it in fiscal year 2020 and then again in 2021. And in 2020, the increase is all in state aid. So for fiscal year 2020, the revenue increases by $9 per pupil and guarantees each district a minimum revenue of $18,750. For charter schools, it's $9 per pupil. Intermediates, it's $18.75, $3.75 per pupil for other cooperative units. And then in 2021 later, that goes up to $54 per pupil for a district with a minimum of $22,500. It's $22.50 for the intermediates, $7.50 for other cooperatives, and $54 per pupil for charter schools. So that's a change from the governor's proposal. It equalizes the Safe Schools revenue at 151.3% of the statewide average tax base per pupil. It expands the uses of Safe Schools revenue, authorizes the school board to transfer Safe Schools revenue to the debt fund for repayment of certain capital and equipment bonds, and requires a district or charter school to report Safe Schools expenditures by functional area. Section 10 modifies the definition of sexual abuse. That's for purposes of investigating maltreatment. Section 11 requires the department to investigate allegations of maltreatment involving students ages 18 to 21 until the student graduates. Section 12 clarifies that school personnel hired with funds from the Support Our Students grant can also work with pre-K pupils. Section 13 states that grants awarded after July 1, 2019, once the grant has been awarded, the recipient has to receive that grant for each of the 6 years of the program. Section 14 is a grant program for public school level 4 programs, and it allows the recipient to use the funds on certain staff development activities. Section 15 requires the commissioner to report to the legislature on sexual health education programs. Section 16 is the appropriations, and Section 17 is an instruction to the revisor to codify program language from 2016, and that should be a reference to Section 14, which is the mental health innovation grants.
Thank you. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members, Article 6 is facilities, fund transfers, and accounting. The first two sections are the same as they were in the policy bill and relate to the lead in school drinking water, both the frequency of testing and the reporting requirements. Section 3 is also from the policy bill and allows a school district to sell or give used computers or tablets to their students. Section 4 is the radon testing, and that language remains the same as reported to this committee by the policy committee. Section 5 has to deal with cooperative units in Minnesota. There's a list in statute of the more common ones, including intermediate school districts and special education cooperatives and education districts and service cooperatives. There are also a couple of school districts that use the regular old joint powers district statute to provide services to their students, and this essentially allows those joint powers districts the same authority as the other named cooperatives to issue bonds that are repaid by their member districts' long-term facilities maintenance revenue. Section 6 is the same intent as the governor's bill, but reworked. It requires charter schools to comply with Minnesota's municipal contracting law. Section 7 combines two provisions regarding the building lease levy. The first of those, Representative Lislegard's bill, was for those sparse school districts that had more than one high school, would allow them to increase their lease levy from the current maximum for all districts of $212 per pupil. The provision that's in the bill limits that to $500 per pupil unit, and due to the testimony of the district saying that they'd gotten an exemption from the commissioner for several years, this provision for the St. Louis County School District wouldn't start until taxes payable in 2024 or fiscal 25. The second provision in the lease levy allows school districts to include in their lease levy amounts the amounts necessary for deferred maintenance projects at cooperative facilities, the special ed and intermediate cooperatives, as long as those facilities have included the work in a 10-year facilities plan. Section 8 is the provision from the policy bill that was originally Representative Poston's bill and defines service cooperatives in the definition of governmental unit as a type of governmental unit. Section 9 are three fund transfers. This committee heard these three transfers, all from the community ed funds. The first for Truman has two parts. It would allow the school district to transfer $65,000 from its ECFE reserved account and $45,000 from its school readiness reserve account and put both those amounts in its general fund. Subdivision 2 is for the Minnetonka School District. The district requested $3.3 million to be moved from its community education reserve account to its operating capital account for purposes of its building costs associated with additional early childhood space. A similar request from Hopkins for $500,000 was presented to the committee from the community ed account, again to the operating capital account for an early childhood classroom addition. Section 10 is the bill the committee heard the other day regarding the Hopkins School District and would allow a willing charter school in the district to combine programming. The provision also would give the Hopkins School District additional levy authority of $50,000 per year for up to 5 years to account for the program merger. Section 11 is the appropriations, as Ms. Adrian has spoken to, and that's Article 6.
Okay, who's on deck for Article 7?
Madam Chair, that's me. Article 7 combines nutrition and libraries. Section 1 is the school meals policy bill, Representative Durgan's bill, that went through ed policy and was contained in 1711. The only change from that to what's in front of you is in Subdivision 5, the time that the participant, who's the food service provider, has to respond and remedy a practice was originally in the bill at 60 days, and that's turned to 30 days here. Section 2 is the Breakfast After the Bell program. The one change from the bill that was heard in this committee is that the requirements on the district's minimum free and reduced lunch count in order to qualify from the program was raised from 33% to 40%. So otherwise, the Breakfast After the Bell program is the same as this committee heard earlier this year. Sections 3, 4, 5, and 6 all affect the regional regional public libraries. There are two sets of changes made. The first of those is the basic support grants for the regional library systems. As Ms. Adrian's pointed out, that funding was increased by $4 million per year. And in addition to the funding change in the bill that was brought to this committee, there were adjustments to the distribution to each of the 12 regional libraries. And the two parts that changed, there's an overall grant that's an equal amount to each of the 12 systems. That now becomes 15% of the total funding available as opposed to the 5% under current law. And the subsequent change was the portion that's currently allocated on each region's tax capacity was reduced from 25 to 15% of the total allocation. Section 5 just clarifies the population count that's used for calculating the regional library aid. And Section 6 is the other change to the regional libraries, and this is to their special aid for telecommunications purposes and would allow, if the districts are fully compliant with what's required under their E-rate program for connectivity, to use any remaining aid for other technology purposes, including network infrastructure, security, things like that, so that those amounts would not cancel back to the general fund. And finally, Section 7 is the appropriations for the nutrition and library programs.
Very good. Article 8.
Madam Chair, members, Ms. Pera has gone through all of the provisions that are in the early childhood article.
Okay.
So we can
move
skip
on.
That.
Ms. Pera, Article 9.
Madam Chair, Article 9. It's a short one. It's the Community Education and Lifelong Learning article. The first section increases the annual statewide adult basic aid amount to $51 million for fiscal year 2020. And then there's the second calculation for the annual growth factor so that the revenue would grow by the greater of either annual growth in the statewide contact hours or the growth in the general ed basic formula allowance. Section 2 modifies the list of characteristics for the education partnerships. That's the grant program that the Northside Achievement Zone and the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood and those other programs, the grant program that gives them funding. So it modifies the list of characteristics for qualifying partnerships. And Section 3 is the appropriations.
Mr. Strom, Article 10.
Madam Chair, members, Article 10 is the second to last article. This is the state agency's article. And briefly, let me go through what's that in that article. The first modifies the duties, Section 1 of the dyslexia specialist at the Department of Education. The second is a provision that was brought to this committee that increases the licensure fee for school administrators from $75 to $100 per year. Section 3 goes along with that change. Right now, the license fees for teachers and administrators go into the same special revenue account, and this would separate the accounts into two parts so that all of the administrative fees would go into their own special revenue fund. Section 4 also goes along with that change as well. Section 5 has to do with the 6-year expiration of the School Climate Technical Assistance Center. This center was formerly named the School Safety Technical Assistance Center. There's a change here in Section 5 and then in the repealer that would extend that center's existence past June 30th. Then there's a series of appropriations in the bill. The first of those in Section 6 is the governor's recommendation to cancel out of the 2019 appropriation $2 million that would have otherwise gone to the Attorney General's office for litigation costs. There's a larger amount that's moved into 2019 for that same purpose. And then in Section 7 is the appropriations for the Department of Education. In addition to the details on the fiscal tracking sheet, there are individual riders on the department's budget, and members should always look through the riders on those appropriations. Section 8 is the appropriation for the Minnesota State Academies. Section 9 is the appropriations for the Perpich Center. Section 10 is the revised appropriations for the Board of School Administrators. That was brought to this committee and appropriates $387,000 in fiscal year 20 and then $347,000 in fiscal year 21 and years going forward to the Board of School Administrators for its activities. Section 11 is the appropriations for the Pelsby Board, and Sections 12 and 13 are the remaining provisions related to the name change and extension of the School Climate Technical Assistance Center. Finally, Madam Chair, Article 11 will be added as a standalone amendment to this bill. What that article will contain is about 30 adjustments to fiscal year 19 appropriations for programs that are aid programs where the understanding between the executive branch and the legislature is that the legislature makes its best effort to fund each program with the best data, known data that it has. If there's an adjustment for these pupil-driven formulas, those adjustments essentially are free when compared to the forecast, but the legislature still needs to make those adjustments in law for them to happen. So the forecast adjustment article will be added to this bill as an amendment, as a standalone article.
Okay, thank you very much. The rest of our agenda will be devoted to public testimony. We have a number of people who have signed up to testify for today. If we don't get through you today, we can have you come back tomorrow. Roger Aronson, it looks Elementary and Secondary Principal Association. And just for information, we're going to try to limit testimony to 2 minutes. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Principals Association, it's a pleasure to be here to talk about House File 2400. At the outset, it takes a lot to get ahead of Scott Prunquist on one of these agendas, and I think this is a major accomplishment for me today to be ahead of Scott. I'm calling in early and all.
Well, I thought we were going alphabetically.
You're going to hear a long line of people that want to thank you for the formula money that's in this bill, for the special ed money that's in this bill, and for the other funding that's in the bill. Obviously, we join in that. Particularly, we are very happy about the money that you put into college and the schools, the money that you put into the Principal's Academy, and the funding that you've done and the structure that you've set up for the Board of School Administrators. Those are all very close to what school principals are doing. We continue to have some issues with the teacher licensure provisions. We have some concerns about the disciplinary provisions, and we think some of those aren't quite ready for prime time, and we'll try to talk to you a little bit about that as we go through this. There's a new disciplinary provision that you're seeing in here from the early learning folks. There's some problematic pieces about talking suspension and expulsion of kindergartners and pre-kindergartners. We're floating around some ideas that maybe we can improve that, to have a different look at that, talk about removal from class. It's kind of interesting, Madam Chair, when we get down to issues of which kids are really appropriate to be in a preschool, some may not be, and how should we process that effectively for the parents and the students that are involved. And I think we have some ideas to go over that with you. My school principals have some heartburn over the student publication pieces on yearbooks and school papers. I think I would point out to you the language that's in this bill, any school district that wanted to could adopt that. What we think is schools should have more flexibility for their administrators in exercising supervisory authority over our kids that are in school, running school papers and involvement with school yearbooks and the other broadcast pieces as well. We note the citizenship language isn't in here. We suspect we haven't heard the last of that, though. There's a rather tenacious supporter of that provision, and we think maybe we'll come back and talk about that as well. But we do appreciate the flexibility that this bill shows relative to curriculum and as we set it up. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Next is Scott Kroonquist, Executive Director, Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and Dr. Sally Boz will be on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Thank you for the opportunity to share a few comments, and thank you for the opportunity to work with you throughout this session. I will also start off with my thanks for several key provisions that were included in our legislative priorities. Number one, the formula increase of 3% in the first year and 2% the second year. We're hoping for 3% in both years, but this is great news for our members. And I would point out, Madam Chair members, that we've done a budget survey, and what we are finding out is that 3% really is the key number. That is what they need, along with some assistance on the special ed side, in order to ensure that our districts are not cutting, not having budget shortfalls next year. As I mentioned, what we found out was the key. It was both the 3% and at least beginning to address that special ed cross subsidy. And we think you have a very solid special education proposal. We are appreciative of the way you address it, establishing that cross subsidy reduction aid, which will recognize those districts that are really getting hit the hardest in that area. Another area we have a cross subsidy is in the English Learner Program. So thank you for that one as well, for addressing that and for providing increased funding for our English Learner Programs. We are also very supportive of the provisions around increasing teachers of color and American Indian teachers. Some excellent provisions there, all the way from the Grow Your Own Program to the Q Program and the American Indian Teacher Preparation Program and the Come Teach in Minnesota hiring bonuses. We think those are all excellent programs. We support the reform of the local optional revenue, rolling that out of the I'm under the gun here, I got to pick it up, and streamlining that process, and also the referendum equalization. Thank you so much for that, and the Safe Schools revenue. We really appreciate your respecting local control, especially as it relates to curriculum and instruction, and for maintaining flexibility for our students to select for electives, and also mentioning local control. Thank you for the Labor Day. We obviously would really like to see the permanent repeal of that prohibition starting before Labor Day, but at least getting that relief for the next 2 years is really appreciated. And then also just want to mention we also have concerns about rolling back the tiered licensure provisions. Hope to continue to work with you on that. We just want to make sure that we continue to have pathways to licensures that will help us address bringing more teachers of color and address shortage areas. So I think I'm out of time. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Kronquist. Dr. Sally Baz? And on deck is Najma Adil. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Sally Baz from Concordia University, and thank you for this opportunity. Want to acknowledge everyone here, and pleased that I am speaking on behalf of Concordia as well as Hamline University Center for Excellence in Urban Teaching, the University of St. Thomas Collaborative Urban Educator Program, the CUE programs. And I want to thank you so much for the provisions in this bill, 2400. And just to say that we are so pleased that we have for so many years been recruiting, training, and preparing teachers of color and American Indians, of course. For over 20 years, our institutions, along with Augsburg, have partnered with the state of Minnesota to increase teachers of color in Minnesota's classrooms and to keep them in those classrooms. We're grateful for the committee's investment of the $6 million. I like to make it billion. That would be really great, wouldn't it? For the Collaborative Urban Educator and Greater Minnesota Educators of Color Grant Program in Article 3, that same base fund of $6 million in fiscal years 2022 and 2023, which is so critical. Additionally, we're supportive, of course, of the increased funding for the Grow Your Own Pathway. We've actually been doing Grow Your Own Pathway for many years. We just haven't called it that. And that is found in Article 3. I've testified in front of the legislator and some of you for 17 years to talk about how important this work is. And we have always at our university and others had 100% teachers of color that we are preparing through the Q program, including students from all around the world. Our program started with just Hmong students and moved to 20 different language groups of students that have represented and Native Americans as well. So while our programs have proven results, and a competitive basis for awarding this grant program does cause some uncertainty for our students and jeopardizes our ability to recruit and retain the best and the brightest teachers. It often takes our students 4 to 6 years to finish, and we heard some testimony last week about people that were having a difficult time. So we look forward to working with the committee on promoting the most effective and meaningful ways to recruit, prepare, and maintain teachers of color in Minnesota schools. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Up next, we have Najma Adil. And on deck is Karen Walters. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Chair, for allowing me to speak on behalf of Augsburg CUE-funded EASE program. My name is Najma Abdillah, and I am pursuing an ESL licensure at Augsburg. In the spring of 2017, I remember debating whether or not to quit school to obtain a second full-time job after experiencing a financial difficulties. Upon hearing about the EASE program at Augsburg University, I decided to transfer to Augsburg the following fall in the hopes that I will be a part of the EASE program. I am grateful to, and I am happy to say that I am completing the final courses of the program this semester and will be student teaching this upcoming fall. Again, thank you, Chair and Committee, for your continuous investment and support on the proposed spending in increasing teachers of color in American Indian Act. These investments are collectively needed to increase the percentage of teachers of color in American Indians, and this will also reflect our state's diverse students. Thank you, and I hope you guys have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Up next is Karen Walters with the Literacy Action Network, and on deck, Gary Amorosa, pardon me. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Walters. I've worked for Mankato Adult Basic Education for 25 years, and I'm currently the chair of Literacy Action Network's Legislative Committee. Thank you for listening to my testimony today regarding Article 9 of HF 2400. I'd like to express our gratitude to your committee for including ABE in the K-12 Education Finance Bill, Omnibus Bill. ABE serves a critical role in our state, educating and credentialing over 60,000 adults annually statewide. Our funding has not kept up with the cost of inflation, and we are thankful that you have considered ABE when you provide increases to K-12. Investing in our low-skilled adults in Minnesota will pay off. First, the adults we serve in ABE are often the parents of our K-12 students. Parental learning and job advancement impact the K-12 families and therefore the system outcomes, as parents are the first teachers in their child's educational journey. Additionally, the adults we serve are a crucial piece of the workforce in Minnesota. ABE provides low-skilled adults the opportunity to learn English, finish high school, and earn credentials that can help them become employed or advance in their jobs. Many of our students are preparing for college, and many are actually completing college certifications and degrees before they leave our ABE system. The ABE system will continue to use resources wisely by collaborating with workforce agencies, human service agencies, and local community and technical colleges to connect adults to the services and supports that they need as they pursue their goals of education and employment advancement. ABE does not try to do it all, but values and works with the systems that you have put in place to assist our clients to move forward. In conclusion, investment in the adult system as well as the K-12 system is critical to providing family sustainability. On behalf of the 60,000 adult learners, the ABE teachers, administrators, staff, and our amazing partnerships in Minnesota, I ask that you please continue to support funding for ABE as you move forward with the legislative process.
Thank you. Gary Amorosa, and on deck is Denise Dietrich. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Amoroso.
Oh, I am sorry. My apologies.
Don't use that. Not a problem, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Chair Dabney for his leadership in this committee. I want to thank all of you for the work that you've done since we convened in January. We're very pleased with the vast majority of the bill. My colleagues called out a number of things. I just want to probably repeat a few. But our number one priority was the formula. As a statewide organization, we want to make sure that we're providing resources that have an impact on every school district in the state. And the 3 and 2 on the formula is something that I think will help us as we continue to move forward. As Mr. Grunquist said, we would like to see 3 and 3, but we understand that there are other needs, and we're thankful for the 3 and 2. We're also thankful for the Grow Your Own pathway, particularly with our paras. We have a lot of great people, and we can provide some resources to help those people move into the teaching profession. That would be fabulous. The Safe Schools Aid, the cross-subsidy resources associated with special ed, we're very thankful for. That's a monster task, but we have to start somewhere, and we're pleased that we're looking at providing those resources. Support our schools, teachers of color, recruitment, retention. Those are things we're all very, very pleased with. The VPK, the maintaining the existing slots, I've heard that from a lot of our superintendents that they weren't sure how they were going to provide those programs moving forward if they didn't have the continued funding. And so we're very pleased with that. I want to thank you for the Labor Day language. Again, we'd like to see that on a permanent basis, but we'll take those 2 years. We're also very thankful that we aren't going to be providing new opportunities for our students that in actuality could limit opportunities for students by not having the civics or the personal finance included. So thank you for that. And a couple areas of quick concern, the tiered licensure piece, we really wish that would be given a chance to grow and develop. We've not even been in it for a year yet, and would really like to see that continue to move forward without the changes. And also the community ed teacher piece, providing the continuing contract and tenure statutes for those staff. We'd prefer that language not be there. But with that overall, we're very grateful, very thankful. Look forward to continue working with everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Dietrich with the Minnesota School Board Association and Josh Delman will be on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association. We want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 2400 today. First of all, we want to thank Chair Dabney, this committee, and the Policy Committee for putting forward very comprehensive policy and finance bills that support all of the 850,000 students in Minnesota. And we acknowledge that this began with a very strong House target of $900 million. So that's our first thank you. Many of the items in this bill closely reflect the Minnesota School Boards Association's legislative agenda, so let me just talk through, remind you of a few of those. The first is to increase the general education formula by 3 and 2%. The second is taking a multifaceted approach to attacking this special education cross-subsidy. Third would be revising the special education funding formula to decrease some of the disparities that the new formula had created. Fourth, increasing the Safe Schools revenue. Fifth, maintaining the funding for voluntary pre-K. Sixth, the pre-Labor Day start. Seventh is your initiatives to increase the teachers of color in Minnesota. Eighth is allowing locally elected school board members to renew an existing operating referenda. However, we must mention that that reverse referendum may cause big problems for some of our school districts. Once again, that could cause an inequity, unintended inequity. The other thing is simplification in accessing LOR, and then we strongly support the five provisions that will help reduce the burden of paperwork for our special education teachers. And then we also would like to just mention that we support the decision not to reduce the number of electives in our high schools. Your bill, Chair Davney, strengthens CTE instruction in our high schools. So this is not the time to add requirements such as personal finance or civics to overshadow those efforts. So we have provided previous testimony on issues that we have concerns about, so I just would like to mention two of those. We are in opposition to reversing any of the changes to the tiered licensure system, and we do not support the early childhood family education and adult basic education teachers being subject to the continuing contracts. So with that, I will conclude my comments.
Thank you. Josh Stellman, and then on deck we have Brad Lundell. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Josh Downham with the I've actually wear three hats today. Very briefly, the Minnesota Youth Council is very appreciative of the funding in this bill for first-time funding. I wish actually Representative Marquardt were here in the room because many of you don't know that he actually drove home on Friday, 6 a.m. turned around, drove back to Minneapolis with a number of his students from his high school to attend the Youth Educational Leadership Summit in Minneapolis, where about 200 students came together to do student-led presentations. He then turned around and drove those students home on Saturday and then drove back here on Sunday. So it speaks to his commitment to his students, but also to the strength of this program. So appreciate the funding in this bill for them. I also represent Minnesota's AmeriCorps programs, and Minnesota Reading Corps and Math Corps appreciate the increases in funding, particularly for the BIE schools, so that they can access more of those services. And then finally, Madam Chair, want to echo many of my colleagues' comments about the funding for schools, whether it's formula, full-service community schools, particularly the special education pieces. I'll touch a little bit more on that. VPK restoration, early middle college for those English language learners. It was great to have the students speak before the committee. And EL funding, and of course, special ed paperwork reduction. And specifically on the special education tuition billing, we're taking, I think, a good first step on that. But districts from Onamia to Columbia Heights, Duluth, Cook County, and Minneapolis are all experiencing some pretty significant challenges around tuition billing. So appreciate starting that discussion. Hopefully in the interim we can start thinking about how to deal with kind of that mismatch between the historic notion of a resident pupil and this hyper-choice environment that we work in. And then lastly, we do have concerns about particularly the Tier 2 licensure changes, and we'll continue to work with Madam Chair and Mr. Chair to deal with those. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Up next is Brad Lundell with Equity in Education, and Mary Gilbert will be on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell here with C, Etc. today. I'll start with Schools for Equity in Education. I can echo just much of what's been said about the concentration on the basic formula, looking at special ed. I can't think of a dollar that's in the bill that's misspent. I think you've done a very good job of looking at a broad range of needs and coming forward with a very comprehensive look, both from the general education, the special education, down to the grant programs. I think you've done a very – you've studied hard, you've worked hard, and you've come up with a good bill in that respect. From C's perspective, we very much appreciate the equalization being included in the bill. We'd also like to have seen debt service equalization, and I think that the state auditor was here earlier today, and they had also had talked about that. They weren't advocating for it, but I think debt service equalization is something that continues to need to be looked at. I also work with the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education. The changes in the policy bill to reduce paperwork are very, very important, and the flexibility in the ADSIS program is also very much appreciated. From the Minnesota Association for Pupil Transportation perspective, we're appreciative of the task force for study school transportation. I think that's something that's long overdue. From the Minnesota School Social Workers and Minnesota School Psychologists, the trauma-informed schools grants, I think, are very that's something that I think is a very worthy effort. And then also the Support Our Students grants that are in the bill as well, I think is something that we've been supportive of as well. Last but not least, the Minnesota Council on Economic Education. We very much appreciate the grant program that's included in the bill for that. It's extremely important to the organization at this point, and I think that is they continue in their mission to provide top-notch staff development to teachers throughout the state. So thank you for all the work you've done this year. Thank you for being open to commentary throughout the session. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Ms. Gilbert. And just a reminder, this is we are taking public testimony, so anyone else wishing to testify, please make your way down. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert Doherty from the St. Paul Public Schools, and I too, I will just echo what others have said. Starting from the $900 million target, funding for the formula, a really huge and big first step on special education to deal with the cross-subsidy along with the policy changes. The EL funding was critical for our district especially, and we're happy to see that was included along with teachers of color, CTE, and college in the school. I think if any of you have been to any of our high schools, the college in the school program is really an opportunity for our students to really get a leg up on post-secondary education, and they're taking credits like you've never seen. The continued funding for the VPK is really, really important for St. Paul. We do run one of the biggest programs in the state, and those kids are all free reduced lunch, EL, or special education, so we are targeting the most at-risk families in our district, and I won't name every individual program that funds student support services or at-risk families, which are included in the bill, along with ABE. Like others, we do still share a few concerns that we have related to the tiered licensing, especially the Tier 2 licensing. It's difficult for us to attract somebody to come in, you know, from another state and go through the process of taking the test and getting the license if they know that they can't be assigned to more than 1 year in a classroom. And so I think that that's an issue for us.
Thank you. Anyone else? Mr. Heller. Oh, I'm sorry. We have time. If you'd like to come down and testify, that's fine. It's a race, whoever gets to there first.
They're both gentlemen.
Yes, I see.
After you.
No, welcome after you. To the committee. Go ahead and state your name and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And we'd like to start by thanking you and Chair Dabney for all your work this session on behalf of our students and educators. Some of the areas that House File 2400 will make progress on include increasing the number of teachers of color, strengthening career and technical education, providing leadership development for principals, enhancing early learning scholarships, while also improving the coordination of the CCAP and Early Learning Scholarship programs. While House File 2400 makes progress in several areas, some of the provisions we'd ask that you reconsider are Article 1, Section 31, which eliminates the right of citizens to vote on a renewal of local referendum levies. Article 3, and the sections that reverse improvements made by the new tiered teacher licensure system. And in addition to the concerns you've heard previously, Sections 29 and 31 effectively eliminate the distinction between a Tier 3 and a Tier 4 license. This is a lost opportunity for recognizing effective teachers. And what makes the need to lower expectations even less clear is Section 29 is proposed because some don't want a local evaluation to impact licensure. Yet at the same time, Section 31 allows a local evaluation to impact licensure. The logic between the two provisions is contradictory. Finally, Section 8 backs away from the state's priority of providing early learning scholarships to low-income families with 3 and 4-year-old children, while Section 8 eliminates the cap on Pathway 2 scholarships, allowing new funds to go to programs rather than directly to low-income families. There are many positives to House File 2400. However, we'd like to work to help make it stronger. And thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Heller. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed. Yep.
Thank you, committee. Education Finance on April 1st. It's not April Fool's either, is it? Name is Rick Heller. I officially represent the people that are twice exceptional. Fallen in House File 1370 on line 118 or Minnesota Statute 120B15, and people with practice disabilities fallen in the IDEA Act of 2004 and Higher Opportunity Education Act of 2008. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on House File 2610. I'm excited to see that they're starting to move with Early Childhood Financing Policy Division on the 2610. I think screening is an important piece. One thing perhaps individuals know, but they call kindergarten entry profile screening, specifically four types of assessments. If you use race to the top funding, we could move this ball just a little edge more to identify those gifts and talents in kindergarten and first grade, those school districts that use those dollars. Especially if we're doing screening for dyslexia up to second grade, maybe we ought to consider using screening for gifted up to second grade. That would be consistent with your policy on identifying dyslexia. People want to turn to page of the summary, page 6, I believe, section 5. I believe that it's missing twice exceptional, and then for number six, the world's best workforce include twice exceptional on 3.18 to 3.14 and 3.18-19.6. Number 7, the world's best workforce district advisory committee, I believe missing print disability or twice exceptional or both, or in lines 38.28, 39.10 through 39.11, and also include Minnesota statute 16E.03, subdivision 9. Legislature is working on a working group. They feel it's important enough that we look at accessibility for the people at the legislature. We should consider school districts to start applying that when it comes to the world's best workforce regarding access. Go to page. I spoke about this before, special education. Unless there's a checkbox on the IEPs, to identify twice exceptional, to consider it. Checkbox also to consider the special protections for people with print disabilities, which is not currently on the special education forms. And number 3 has to do with letting parents know that it's a standard-based IEP. Parents do not know that, and frankly, if they do not know that, their goals and objectives may be part of the MCAs, which are done in the classroom, what they can do independently. And just so we all know, on page 38, under item 5, it mentions minute, lines 239.26 Reason minutes in there is their school districts and state agencies, they have to do accessibility law. But when it comes to the other school districts, we should be applying this accessibility law for individuals that are twice exceptional and print disabled. Once again, they're quasi, and they have to do state accessibility law. Consider that in the future as we move ahead on how people are going to acquire and engage and enjoy the same information as their peers. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Members, just a reminder, we will not be meeting Wednesday or Thursday. We'll be doing our amendment to the DE. Anybody wishing to submit an amendment should have those to Ms. Burt by 5 o'clock tomorrow. Oh, I'm sorry. We will not be meeting on Wednesday. Thursday, we will be doing our markup. So come back Thursday, please, and thank you. And we have minutes. Ms. Representative Edelson, would you like to move minutes, please?
So moved.
All right. And with that, any discussion to the minutes? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Nay?
I'll wait to talk to you.
Motion prevails. Representative Krisha.
Thank you. Just a question. Do you know when we'll have district runs? Do you expect that before the markup, Mr. Do you have any idea?
I'm going to throw that to nonpartisan staff, yeah. Representative Krisha. I don't do those runs myself.
Mr. Strom.
Probably a good idea, Mr. Chair.
Probably is.
Madam Chair, Representative Krisha, we're busy working on those. If nothing else, we'll have individual runs on things like special education, but we're hoping to get things assembled in time for Thursday's hearing.
And I would just, I mean, certainly do what's best and expedient for you and not, just as long as we know. I mean, I think Thursday would be just fine.
And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.